Previously on X-Friends.
Because who doesn't love a milkshake? I mean, look, if you're in a horrible future and you get to come back to the 90s, it's like, well, I'm going to have a milkshake.
I would have a milkshake if I knew that was my last meal.
Just because she can do it alone doesn't mean she should have to.
Imagine how confused I was keeping X-Factor and X-Force straight in my head.
The cards are always in the X-Men's favor.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this thing that I have every right at this point to do. Now we're talking.
Yeah, you're right. They spent another $50 million on a secret.
Yeah, and it's coming in 5 more years.
Yeah.
Just keep hanging on. Hi, everybody, and thank you for joining us. I am Nick Scheist. You may remember me from the Scheist Podcast and Bad Movies We Love.
And I'm Seth Vargas of the Movie Friends Podcast.
And we decided to join forces, a team up, if you will, because X-Men 97 was so good, we just couldn't help ourselves.
That's right. So join us as we discuss our personal history with the comics, the films, and the collectible trading cards of the X-Men universe.
And of course, the catalyst for it all, X-Men 97.
To me, my X-Friends.
We're back once again for episode 3, season 2, Rise of Apocalypse, part 1. We get to see a little bit more of the man that will become Apocalypse. And if this season really is like the Apocalypse season for the whole thing, right, where Bastion is sort of like the secret villain through the first half of the season and then comes out in the second half. And Saba Noor as a character, I think taking the time to really sort of like humanize him and explain that like this guy's a slave. He's coming from a position of, yeah, of course you would want to like kill your master. And like, of course you have like very troubled relationships, and him having to have some of these kind of like moral discussions with both Charles and Magneto about like what it means to be a person with power, and to see him try to reason, because he's also got the guy who raised him, essentially, who is, basically a warlord kind of, and is very much about like survival of the fittest and pushing him to basically like just kill your enemies and take over. It's interesting to me because so many stories that we've seen, I would want to say maybe what the last like 15 years, are going back to look at someone who we knew as a villain, who's always been the villain, and they're like, well, now we're giving them an origin story to sort of humanize them and explain why they are the villain and why they're actually secretly not really the villain. There's been a ton of that. I mean, Cruella, like Wicked, is essentially like that kind of story as well. This sort of like revisionist look at Tex. And I think to a certain extent, it is good to acknowledge that like bad people are also complicated people. Like they are still people, and they have reasons for doing the things that they do. And if you don't actually stop to sort of investigate those reasons, you will not like understand why they do what they do. And then whether or not you choose to then use that as leverage to sort of try to push the audience into the camp of like, oh, they're not actually the villain, that is something that it looks like this show wants to do briefly. And it's sort of sitting on the precipice of like, do you really want to go back and reexamine Apocalypse as this, you know, tortured potential hero? Because in the Kirkman series that was out a couple years ago, where all mutants are on the same page, like they're like Apocalypse is on the team, right? They all live together in mostly harmony, but like we've seen a version of Apocalypse already in the X-Men canon that is still him, but is much more measured and much less bent on killing the rest of them.
Yeah.
So like this is an interesting place to take Apocalypse, and I don't know that we've seen a ton of origin about him, but I don't know. What do you think? Do you like Ensaba Nuer?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, it's an interesting way of telling the story. One version of him, and then the other version of him, and the two kind of philosophies that are fighting for his fate, both in the past and in the future. So it does make it feel a little more grand, and like it does give a little bit more time to him, because you get to see him at two different times in his life. Here in the past, I kind of like the only part that I didn't really like was the Ball character, who is just like Kratos,
like, yeah, yeah.
in every way, shape, and form. And I was like, okay, you know, why is this guy bullying around a dude that we just saw pick up an elephant by its tusk?
Is he going to pick it up?
Yeah, like whip it around. And I understand the idea of like, hey, you were enslaved. This is the guy who enslaved you. Not only are the stakes high for your mission, but this is now very personal. And so he gets to experience what Charles is after, and he gets to experience what Eric has experienced. So it's smart. Like, it's very smart the way that they're doing it. And like, it kind of seems a little simple, but I think there was a lot of thought put into like really facing him with these choices. On that subject of, you know, revising what we've known about villains, you know, probably the biggest amount of time and money devoted to that was the prequel trilogy of Star Wars, where when you and I were growing up, there was Darth Vader. End of story.
Yeah.
You know, he already had a moment to dive into who he was and where he came from. That's, you know, the end of Return of the Jedi. Then devoting three films to being like, no, this is why and how and when and who and, you know, all of the W's are going to get answered over the course of like, I don't even know, 7 hours. I don't even know how long those movies all add up to, but it's a long amount of time. And, you know, depending on how you feel about the prequel trilogy, you might say it's worth it or it's not worth it. I think it's interesting sometimes, but I also just like a villain. I just like a bad guy who is a bad guy. I don't really care why he is that way all the time. You know, thinking of the heights of superhero adaptations in our lifetime, we're of course always going to go to Heath Ledger as the Joker, who is a bad guy who is not explained, like, at all. And there's something so undeniable, yes, of course, about the performance, but also about the character. And so yeah, all of these instincts that all of these studios and teams have to be like, let's pull the curtain back. You have the prime example of why you don't do that and how it works better when you don't really know all of these things about this person. So I'm really of two minds. Like, I'll tell you, I'm a lot more interested in the past story.
Yeah.
Because we know, you know, getting into that thing that we were talking about in the first episode, this whole idea of fate and time travel. And genuinely, does anything that they're doing have any effect? Does it matter at all? I kind of don't think so, because if it did, the team in the future would probably be seeing things change around them every time Eric and Charles say something different. So I don't think that they're really having an effect on anything, but it is still an interesting philosophical musing of like, okay, again, like you guys had this incredible sequence together of them, you know, talking in that small building, you know, as like the water's coming in and like, you know, they're discussing their different philosophies and whatnot. And now they're forced into a situation where ultimate power lies in front of them and they have to decide whether or not to like kill it or try to harness it. And that's the Eric and Charles thing. Charles can do anything he wants at all times, but he kills that power within himself. And Eric is trying to harness whatever power and leverage he can to, you know, sway the tide. So I'll be curious to see where this ends up. And I do like that even though we know what Apocalypse will become, that they're giving his character room to be curious and to have doubts before he does become the, like, I'm Apocalypse, end of story, you know, I'm just a force of nature. So, yeah, I know, I just, like, said a bunch of doublespeak, but but it will all depend on how it shakes out. You know, like if this ends up sucking, then I'll be like, wasn't that good of an idea to begin with.
Well, I think one of the things I like about this episode, like especially with the benefit of hindsight, is how much we get to see Magneto at least step into the role of mentor. Yeah. Whereas like him and Charles have had a lot of these conversations over the years and like they've always had this push and pull between the two of them. But even when Magneto takes over the X-Men, he is a leader under a great deal of pushback with them. And so the X-Men don't necessarily like take advice from him. He doesn't really even necessarily give it to them either. You don't see much of him trying to pass his philosophy on to the X-Men until like the very end of that season where it's like, okay, well, everything you said was basically correct and now you have to choose, are you coming with me or are you staying here, right?
Right.
And so in this case, to like see him kind of enamored with En-Sabah-Noor and not only like trying to sort of be the voice of reason for him, you know, he's got some like great quotable lines in this, like it's only through struggle that one comes to understand the true value of power. He tells him,
yes,
only a coward feels mighty when stepping on ants. So he's trying, yes, to like give these lessons to Apocalypse, and Charles is the one who has this like pushback. But my question for you is Magneto doing this as a means to an end for his own selfish reasons?
Right.
Because what he's trying to do is get Apocalypse to believe in what Charles wants of the future. And he communicates that to Charles, like, imagine your dream started with him like 5,000 years earlier. Imagine, right, like the future for mutants at that, right, point. And so like it both serves his kind of specious view of, right, mutantdom. And it also serves Charles' view of like a sort of like a harmonious and like safe existence for a lot of mutants. So yeah, I am sort of curious like what his ultimate motivation is, because I feel like his villain arc is already behind him, right? He's not like, oh, I want to sort of be, you know, the Dick Cheney to Apocalypse, right?
Right, right. That would... I would not like that, to be, yeah, honest with you. If at some point in the story, you know, Magneto spins around and looks at Charles and he's like, gotcha, I'd be like, That sucks because that does kind of undo everything. And, you know, we were talking about the idea of like flying through stories. And I was like, wow, remember last season when Charles went and lived with the bird people?
In space.
I was like, oh, yeah, they did that. Just fit that in to a very full season.
The Shi'ar stopped by for one episode.
Yes, yes. Oh, my God. So, yeah, I mean, and this could be, you know, this could be the thing that breaks Charles and Eric up after this season, right? Like things go south or whatever. But no, I think that Eric believes what he's saying. I think that he means what he's saying to Charles here. Like he's like, yeah, we can do, which again, I don't like also because that's insane. And that makes Eric seem less smart than I believe, you know, he is.
That's kind of why I asked about the motivation part.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that he's being genuine, and I think it's also a fun switch for Charles to be the one who's like, we should kill this guy. Not that he necessarily said that, but like Charles is now the one who's like, the end justifies the means in this case. And Eric is like, whoa, 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 hold on. This is a, you know, school for gifted children type of situation. Let's do the X-Men thing with him. And he says, he's like, he could be the first, not just the first mutant, he could be the first X-Men. And it's like, okay, maybe. But again, like, Eric, are you going to live here? Like, do we live here now?
Right. we are 5,000 years out of our timeline.
Yeah. Like, because if not, you know, 2 days with Magneto isn't going to change. He's already on this like villainous, murderous rampage. It's one of revenge, right? But it's not like they're catching him when he's like a child still in chains. And they're like, okay, let's take this kid and work. He's already halfway there. So I don't think it's a good plan. I don't think it's a good plan.
Yeah, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, we see towards the end of the episode that some of the X-Men's meddling with Beast and his little bifocals trying to build a way home is part of this episode, and that's it leans into this thing of deception that pops up a couple of times here, and that, you know, you have these displaced strangers and they're like, well, we're like, we're lying to you, but we're kind of like just withholding information. And then again, like, oh, we caught you. Well, yeah, but we're really just like not telling you everything, because if we did, then our plan would not work. And so you get the betrayal, I think, that is like a primary catalyst for what we see here. And the episode ends with the Pharaoh fidgeting around with his gadgets and launching a gigantic laser beam into the sky.
Yeah. Yeah.
It looks gnarly.
Yeah, I gotta be honest with you. I rewound this part like twice because I was like, what did I miss? Like, what happened? Where did we get? But yeah, I guess that's why this episode is called Part One, because
yeah,
I guess some things go down in Part Two.
Yeah, I have already seen the next episode. You are still on the other side of that wall. So
yes. We're
going to leave that there. One of my favorite scenes in this episode is the X-Men all gathered around the round table, like having to sit there and watch them kind of like break bread with Apocalypse as if everything is normal, and you get like Beast and Rogue and Nightcrawler all sort of scowling. And it is a very funny moment. So I think the show like knows when to insert its sense of humor versus a lot of the formula that we have seen, I think, pretty much since Guardians 1. That movie, that style of humor then became like the default kind of joke structure for almost all of the MCU movies that followed it. And so like the samesiness of that, I think, got tired for people after a while. So to see that like the show can have a sense of humor without kind of relying on the same type of jokes, I think, is important. And maybe because it's animation, like you can just draw things the way that you want to draw them to give it the kind of personality you want.
Yeah. Well, and it's subtle. It's subtle.
It is.
And they're short episodes, so things have to keep moving. There's not a ton of time to really be like, hey, here's the joke. Hey, did you notice that joke? So, yeah, I don't know. Yes, that part is very fun.
I did start cooking up theories during the watch of this episode with like where the Pharaoh got his technology. I started like asking a lot of those questions, and I was like, all right, maybe I don't look up to see if I'm if my theories have any momentum. Let me just save it. And so there is some speculation as to like where these robots are coming from in ancient Egypt. And I like that Nightcrawler has, again, a moment like that, too, where like, oh, did anybody see you scavenging for parts? He's like, we're in, you know, there's robots walking around and Apocalypse is out here. Like, do you think anybody's going to really care if they see what they think is a demon? Like, we're fine. It's like, chill out, professor.
I think it's not that it's cheap, but there is so much emphasis on him being the first mutant.
Yes.
So I kind of wish that we weren't. It's like, he's the first mutant who also just happened to be around in a time with robots and big lasers. Just make it normal. Like, that's already interesting. It's already interesting to have a Brightburn, you know, here is Superman amongst mortals with no technology. Now what? And so for them to even have any kind of, you know, like power matching with him, I was like, I don't buy that. Like, yeah, I don't buy that. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Well, things will be revealed in time.
Yeah.
But the sort of like the moral compass of the entire pretty much like Ensaba Nur arc to this point, the fight between Charles and Magneto for like who this guy is and who he could be does come to a head in this episode. Maybe a poor choice of words there, but there is a beheading.
Yes.
In this episode. So we get a guy shot in the head, and then we get not only is there a beheading, but there's like blood splatter from the beheading as well. And you get Charles' face reacting to that like, oh boy.
Yep.
This is why we can't save this guy.
Yeah. And going back to your point about, you know, what's Eric's motivation? He's the one who stops it the first time.
Yeah.
He didn't have to do that. He could have been like, okay, you know. But he says that before Eric gave him guidance, that his followers, like, feared him. But now they follow him. And this is also kind of, I think, a good meditation on, you know, our current political situation, which is when you know someone is bad, how far do you go in trying to fix that person? Or do you just say, we cannot have this person be in charge? Like, how far do you go down? And again, like, Charles is normally on the side of giving patience and grace and understanding and forgiveness and all those things. So it's very interesting to see that even he is like, no, there is a limit to what you can allow and permit and forget and forgive and hope that things will be different. And, you know, not that I hope that there's no positive outcome for him in this timeline. It's like, look, sometimes you just got to take a look and say, this is a bad person. They should not be allowed to be in charge of us.
You would think so. Wait till they get to X-Men 2026.
Yeah, Magneto's like, no, Charles, I can show him. I can guide him. It's like, no. I mean, because ultimately, you know, the devil and the angel on your shoulder who are fighting ultimately are, you know, superfluous. That's not the right word. They're only fighting with each other because ultimately it's your will that's going to make the choice as to what you're going to do. And so, you know, they're not fighting with you. They're fighting with each other. And we'll see. But I don't know. I think, again, if all of this training and guidance was going to make a difference, I think that we would see some kind of after effect of that. So I don't have faith that Apocalypse or Al Sevener, you know, becomes someone else.
Yeah, because then what would he do anyway? He would just, like, you recruit him to fight other Apocalypse, and it's an Apocalypse battle.
Maybe that's where this is going. Maybe the young and old will fight each other, and, you know.
Well, you mentioned Will there for a second, and so I want to ask you, because this is a time travel story, because we've talked a lot about fate, you know, because Mother Ascani says, like, you know, everybody is basically victims to the winds of fate, right? Nobody can fight fate. Mm-hmm. Are you a free will guy? Do you believe in free will? Because I think that's kind of like what we're seeing here, even though it's not in the future storyline. Like, mm-hmm. you're seeing these two people trying to affect this one person's decision, mm-hmm. and then still get found out.
Yeah, absolutely I am. I just think that most people's free will is very weak. And so, like, to say that I believe in free will is not to say that I don't believe in other forces. So my free will can absolutely be affected by my brain chemistry. Like, my free will is not necessarily the strongest force at play, but it is at play. I do think that everyone has a decision to make at every moment in their life. Do they take that opportunity? No. I think a lot of people live based on the weather, the circumstances that surround them, and not to downplay those things. You know, I don't think that expecting a person who did not ask to be born, who was not trained and not equipped, to ask that person to just work so hard and will yourself out of poverty, let's say, or out of an abusive situation. You are requiring that person who didn't ask for it, who is going through the pain of that experience, you're asking them to try harder than other people. That's craziness. Like, that's insane. Does that happen? Yes, of course. There's tons of stories of people who, you know, quote unquote, rose above their lot in life to make a better life for themselves. But how crazy is it for us to require that of people? That's nutso. So I think that there are other forces at play, but I think that your will is always one of them. You always have a choice. And I know that I always have a choice because I've done things that are against my programming constantly. And I do things that are absolutely insane because I'm like, I'm going to do this now. And then I do it.
Well, that approach, I think, sort of changes the relationship that like the three of them have in this episode. Because if you look at Apocalypse as like a force of nature, right, that like his destiny is to be Apocalypse, then it's like nothing Charles does, nothing Magneto does actually matters. But if the other case is true, then their actions are potentially directly responsible for shaping Ensaba Nur into like maybe the thing that they fear the most.
Right. Well, and I think that there is a hint given that that might happen because Charles says to him, you told him that we believe there's a destiny for something.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you told him that we think that there's a plan for him. Whoa. And so I think that, being in the fragile state that he is in of, you know, I've had this one person who saved my life and now here comes these other people and they're kind of telling me something and that kind of sounds good. And hey, look, it kind of worked a little bit. When he realizes that, you know, they're either there to kill him or that they were lying, or I think that the hurt of that, hey, I put myself in a vulnerable place with you and you screwed me too. Well, guess what? Now I also hate mutants. I didn't hate any mutants before because I didn't know any, but now I meet new mutants. Guess what? Now I'm killing everybody.
Yeah, the first mutants I ever met, you lying bastards.
Yeah, and so I think that Eric's, you know, good intention, but I think that him being deceptive might come back to bite them in the butt. I love, just want to say one of, and it's kind of a throwaway line. Like it's not like something that hangs in the air when, El Salvador says, you know, he's talking about growing up and being different. And he's like, I would pray, you know, whose image am I made in? It's like, oh my God. Like, wow. Like that's such a fantastic and horrible and horrifying, but I think that's something that a lot of people who are different or were born different or they aren't, you know, who is their image, who were they made after, because everybody else seems to be made after someone else. And so for them to pull out that, like, I think semi-universal nugget of like pain. Like, who am I? Who made me? Why am I made this way? Is just, it's great writing. Like, I can't, you know.
Yeah, speaks to the existential crisis within us all.
Yes, right? Yes. But then they just put it in this, like, comic book show. And again, it's not like the final line of an episode. It's just here in a monologue. It's great. It's really good.
Yeah, and, you know, we see both, I think. I think it's the episode with, like, the best overall sort of quotable lines. Mm-hmm. And I think we do see that, I think, Charles' fatal flaw and Magneto's fatal flaw are both sort of, like, present in the same time. And they are sort of, like, confronted with the fact that they, like, maybe failed in a way that, like, Eric kind of like backed them into a corner, but they maybe failed in a way that like they didn't anticipate, not just failing, but they didn't like foresee what failure could potentially cost them, which I find to be interesting. It's like the hubris of both of them. Like, their egos are always these two big things. I mean, it is like their two egos that are clashing throughout the eternity of X-Men stories. So it is kind of interesting that, like, that is what is happening in this episode. But towards the end, you know, they both try to intervene. I think Charles gets, like, mind blocked by Ensaba Noor and, like, is physically afflicted by it, or he's like, he's inside his mind, he's looking for something, and he falls, and Eric catches him, and the entire bar yelled kiss.
that's awesome.
The people want these two to be lovers at right. some point. And yeah. it's like, it's kind of this thing that's always been under the surface, like between the two of them. They clearly love each other like very, very much. But right. yeah, I think the more modern iterations have sort of begun to like lean more into that side of things, which I think like is appropriate, honestly, for like their history. But
yeah,
you know, who knows?
Yeah. So somewhere in here, Charles goes on a little trip to a temple.
Yes.
And a voice is like, go away. This isn't until later.
Yeah, but again, you've showed up too soon.
It's like, okay. So something beyond apocalypse is encroaching and or orchestrating, so it's just a little way of teasing whatever's coming next. Maybe, I don't know, it could turn out to be nothing.
Yeah, he reads the mind of the slave catcher, I guess. Yeah, when trying to find something out, to find the location of something. And
yeah
so yeah, you've got a journey ahead of you in the next few, so enjoy. You text me when you're done. You let me know what you think in short form. And then we'll reconvene and we'll cover 4, 5, and 6. And then we're still going to release them all episodically. And then maybe, just maybe, we will get on track before the season is over.
Oof. That's the goal.
That is the goal. It's lofty, but it's possible.
Yep.
We've got like 3 weeks.
We have free will at our side.
We do. We're going to put it to the test.
Yep. But like I said,
all right, man.
Mine might be weak.
That's fair. Well, it's been good to get the ball rolling back again. I'm glad that we're doing this. And yeah, I think that's it. I don't got nothing special. I got quotes, but I'll put those at the end. Oh, there is actually one thing. The one special thing for us coming back together. Give me, let's say, 5 minutes.
Okay.
I have saved this specific thing to look at because it is an X-Men sort of personality chart.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to read through a couple of these quickly and you tell me which one sounds like you. So the life mission is help humanity evolve. You see potential before others do. You inspire people to become better, whether through ideas, education, or leadership. You're here to raise humanity. number 2, life mission, heal through your own story. Your greatest strength comes from what you've survived. The people you're here to help are often walking a path you've already overcome. Number 3, protect harmony and nurture life. You can bring calm to chaos. You protect what matters. Your gift is helping people live in greater harmony with themselves and others. Number 4, life mission is awaken people to their true potential. You see beyond who people are today. You see who they could become. Your gift is helping others discover their strength, wisdom, and potential that has been within them all along. I think this is number 5. Life mission is play an important role. You believe in purpose, responsibility, discipline. You're happiest when your life contributes to something bigger than yourself. Number 6 is life mission, learn, understand, and teach. You're endlessly curious. Knowledge isn't just for you. You're here to help others make sense of the world. Number 7 Help people feel they belong. You know what it feels like to be different. That's why you naturally make others feel accepted. Kindness is one of your greatest gifts. Number 8, challenge old systems. You question everything, not to create chaos, but because you believe things can be better. Real change needs people willing to change the status quo. Number 9 is heal through relationships. Love is one of your greatest teachers. Through every relationship, you learn to trust, to set healthy boundaries, and what it truly means to let yourself be loved. Maybe this is 10. Protect what truly matters. Beneath your confidence lies a fiercely loyal heart. You're here to protect the people you love and remind us that real love isn't about words. It's about showing up again and again. That's the last one.
Wow. Okay. I had to pick one.
Yes.
Okay. So each one that you read, I was like, yeah, I like that. And then you read another one. I was like, oh man, I think that I would be somewhere between, I'm going to pick only one, but 8 for sure. 8 for sure.
Let me count them again in my head.
1, 2, 3.
Eight was the challenge of old systems.
Yeah. Either 3, 4, or 8.
All right. Well, 8 is Magneto.
Oh!
Let me see. 3 is Storm. And 4 is Jean Grey, who I think is probably closest to Charles that isn't Charles.
The one that was like, you see past where people are.
Yeah, you see beyond who people are today. You see who they can become. Your gift is helping others discover the strength, wisdom, potential that has been within them all along. That sounds kind of like what you described at the end of season one.
Yeah, I would say probably that one, it would be like the one that I want the most. Like, I very much am a fan of, I mean, 8 is like me on my own. Like, if I'm given something to do, it's like, oh, tear all of this apart. You know what I mean? Like, no. We do not do things just because it's the way things were done. Whenever I hear that, I want to throw up. But when it comes to my relationships with other people, it's definitely like, how do we work on you becoming the best version of yourself? So I think I'll go with it. I think I'll stick with that one because that's the one that I want to be.
That's fair. It's funny that you did pick Magneto, though, so maybe the people were not wrong.
Okay, which one do you pick?
I like the Cyclops one, which is 5. Mm-hmm. It says, play an important role. Believe in purpose, responsibility, discipline, happiest when contributing to something bigger than yourself. That's the reason I like Cyclops in the first place, is because he is a very like steadfast person in the face of a lot of adversity. I think the one that maybe surprised me the most was Gambit, which is protect what truly matters. Beneath your confidence is a fiercely loyal heart. You're here to protect the people you love and remind us that real love isn't about words. It's about showing up again and again. So very similar in that like steadfast kind of presence, I think. Mm-hmm. I am obviously a Cyclops loyalist, though, so.
Right, right. Wow, so you and I are Cyclops and Jean.
Who knew?
That's good.
Maybe better than Magneto and Charles.
Yeah, yes, definitely, definitely.
Well, to any of the listeners out there, if you want to chime in, let us know which X-Men personality type you are. Got to listen to all those again, and hopefully you get the number right, because I don't know that I did. I can send you the test. And then you let us know. But yeah, we'll reconvene hopefully soonish. And we'll be back with more X-Friends.
All right, until then, thanks.
Thanks for checking out the show and becoming an X-Friend. Hopefully you'll join us on our journey through X-Men 97 and beyond. X-Friends is a Movie Friends and Bad Movies We Love co-production and part of the Scheist Podcast Network, hosted by Seth Vargas and me, Nick Scheist. You can find all of our contact info and socials in the show notes, and you can email the show directly at xfriends@thescheist.com. That's the letter x-friends@thescheist.com. So until next time, we live in an age of darkness, a world full of fear, hate, and intolerance. But in every age, there are those who fight against it.